For this Christmas Day episode of the Morning Glory Project, I bring you, I guess it's the ghost of Morning Glory Project past. We're bringing you a reprise of our inaugural episode featuring the delightful and inspiring Eileen Rendall. Wherever you celebrate, however you celebrate, whatever you celebrate, I wish you joy. I wish you peace. I wish you comfort. Merry Christmas from the Morning Glory Project. Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, stories of determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbinder. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. Today, I'm so happy to be interviewing Eileen Rendall. She's a person that I was able to encounter first because we happened to be members in the same writing organization. I got to meet her and know her. And when I found out who she was, I didn't even realize I had read one of her books before. I didn't put two and two together. But when I did, I got to be inspired by her story. Here's a bit about Eileen. In 1999, Eileen Rendall's husband passed away due to a malignant brain tumor, leaving her at 37 with two small boys to raise on her own. There is absolutely no way she would have gotten through that and the subsequent years without the love and support of her amazing family, especially her two sisters. She fictionalized that experience in part as a way to process all that had happened, including finding new love and the guilt that comes with being a surviving spouse. That book, Do Me, Do My Roots, went on to be a finalist for the National Reader's Choice Award and a double finalist for the Rita Award. Since then, she has published 15 more books under several different names in genres ranging from chick lit to psychological thriller. So welcome, Eileen Rendall. I'm so happy to be talking with you. My opportunities to overlap and have our paths cross are always too infrequent and delightful every time they do. So I'm thrilled to be able to have you as a guest on this program. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Eileen, you are a prolific author across many genres, from everything from chick lit to romantic suspense to, I don't know what else you call all of the other books that you do, but they're across the romance and suspense genres. And I'd love to talk to you about those things, but today I'm going to focus a bit on one specific book. It's one of your, I always thought it was your first book, but I've since learned it was your second, which is the book called Do Me, Do My Roots. Can you tell me a little bit about this book and how it came to be?
Absolutely. I was already interested in writing and had been working on writing a romance novel, and it came out from a very small press and which basically went out of business pretty much as soon as my book came out. But I wanted to continue writing and I wasn't quite sure what to write. And well, let me set this up a little bit more. In 1998, my husband was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor and he passed away in July of 1999. He was 50, I was 37, and our kids were 7 and 5. And that first book that I was writing was magical in that I could go into another world and control what was going on because my life was very out of control. So I wanted to continue writing, but I wasn't really sure what to write. And my sister Marion, there's three of us, she's the middle, is a nurse. And at the time she was working in the emergency room and she would get off work at about 11 and need to decompress, need to talk to somebody. And I was not sleeping very much. So she would call me and she would tell me these outrageous stories. She's really the funniest person I know and probably the best storyteller I know. And I started writing down what she was saying to me. And pretty soon I had this like pretty massive file of hysterical things. And I was looking at it and I thought, this is the story of us. This is the story of how my sisters and I and our family survive these horrible things that have happened to us. And that's where I got the idea to start writing Do Me, Do My Roots.
So Do Me, Do My Roots, if, for those who haven't read it, and everyone should, because it's a delightful story, but it's a fictional account that mirrors a bit of your own experience in losing your husband and having two small children, correct?
Yes, exactly.
So you got some of these ideas from your sister. I didn't know that.
Oh my gosh. Well, because I mean, the whole thing is really about the three of us in a lot of ways. And she is just out. She's so funny. I think the one that really tipped me over the edge was she called me and said, "We need to go and get something really interesting tattooed on our butts." And I was like, "Why?" She said, "That way, when we're old, people will want to come and wipe our butts for us just to see the interesting tattoo." Oh, no. It's like that kind of problem solving. How do you not like just take advantage of that?
Well, that was a blessing that you were born into, I'll tell you. That's terrific. Well, and you're bringing this up, I mean, you're talking about the positive and then the negative, of course, but humor is such an important part of who you are, as well as how you write, at least in the romantic and humorous kind of chick lit books, that I can see that it came from your family and must have been a really important part of your coping strategy to be a young mom with two young children and to lose your husband relatively suddenly like that. It sounds like humor is a big part of what got you through.
It totally was. It was easier sometimes to laugh than cry. Because there were times I was afraid if I started crying, I wasn't going to be able to stop. Actually, at Fred's memorial service, you know, people are coming up and hugging you and telling you how sorry they are. And I finally just started saying, "Don't give me too much sympathy right now, or I will not make it through the afternoon." And so a couple of my friends would just come up periodically and whisper like something really rude in my ear. So I would laugh and I could keep the tears at bay because I don't know how I would have gotten through all of it. I actually have probably blanked out a few moments of it. The humor thing has, it's totally gotten me through, and especially those sort of emergency situations when you've got to keep your cool, you got to keep going, you got to handle it. But it has a flip side that is not as positive. That took me quite a while to figure out. And because I found a way to skate along using the humor, sometimes it took me longer than it should have to go ahead and feel the feelings that you've got to feel before you get through something.
So the laughter worked for the short term, but not necessarily for the healing.
No, for the healing, I think the only way to the other side is through it. And the humor kind of kept me on one side.
So when you knew your husband was going to pass, and ultimately when he did, what was the dark moment? What was that like without the funny, right? Without the funny.
I have one funny, one not funny. Absolutely.
Well, okay. We can have both.
The not funny was, he was in the ICU again, and it was the moment that his neurosurgeon told me there was nothing else. We had done everything that they knew how to do. There was nothing else. And I'm sure that in my heart of hearts, I knew that that was coming, but to have him say it, it was one of the moments where I dissolved. And I remember him saying it. And I remember my sister and my mother-in-law on either side of me practically carrying me out of the ICU. And I can't tell you what the rest of that afternoon was, because I was just in the depths of it. And then you had to come back out, because I had two kids to take care of, and he needed help, and there were decisions to be made, and then the humor sort of snaps back in and gets you so you're walking through it upright.
Hmm. Well, what do you think you were, I mean, in addition to just losing someone you love and losing the father of your children, what were you most afraid of?
I don't know that it was fear. Or if there was fear, it was fear that I would never feel any other way than I felt at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a sensation in your chest. I don't know how else to describe it. That just, I woke up with it every day and went to sleep with it every night. And there was a period of time where I just thought, well, this is my new normal. This is how I live.
Eileen, I'm so touched that you're sharing it this way, because I think that's where we get when we're in despair, that it doesn't feel like it's ever going to stop. It doesn't feel like we're going to ever be different or even back. Not that we want to be exactly as we were before. We don't want to forget our losses, but we're afraid that we'll never feel any better than we feel right now. I think that's why not everyone makes it. If you feel that horrible and you don't have any confidence that it's ever going to get any better, golly, you can see why some people fold up, right? They either drink or disappear or hide or lose hope, or some even tragically take their lives, whatever it might be. So it sounds like you reached that kind of moment in the dark forest, so to speak. And then what began to turn for you?
I think a lot of it is time. Because it just, you have to give it time to get through it, to lighten some. And again, my family they were amazing and kept me going, kept me laughing. There were friends who also kept me moving, kept me going. And, you know, and I eventually started a new relationship, which is actually also part of the whole, part of Do Me Do My Roots, because I felt a lot of guilt about moving on that way. Mm. And I needed to process that as well.
So it sounds as though the writing of the book was part of your reparative process too.
Absolutely. Because it let me, you know, I told you about the afternoon I fell apart, but that mostly I would try to stay on the surface of things. And writing about it let me delve into the emotions in a way that felt controlled. I didn't have to fall apart. I could approach it through fictional me, so I could still process it and think about it without it absolutely sucking me back down into that pit of despair again.
Well, now that's the second time you've used the word control. Somehow not surprising. But when you said you were writing the first book before your husband passed, that it was a world you could control, right? And here you're talking about writing Do Me Do My Roots, and you could control this fictional version of your life in a way that you couldn't necessarily control what was really going on. Does that feel accurate?
You know, it does. Although I would be the one to tell you that, I am so not a control freak. That's my big sister. She's the one who always has to be in charge. But I think, you know, we all want to be the captains of our own ships.
Well, maybe you're not a control freak about other people's existence, but perhaps, and I guess I don't even love the term control freak. I think that it's human nature to want to feel at least a little bit in that you're the master of your own destiny, or like you say, the captain of your own ship. It sounds comparatively healthy to me.
Oh, good.
Not that you asked for a diagnosis, but well, so you said you had a dark story, which was that moment of when you walked out of that ICU that day, but you also said that there was a lighter moment that helped you move from there.
So Fred came home on hospice, and we were taking care of him at the house, and he was completely bedridden by that time. And dealing with medical stuff like that, I mean, nothing gets reused. Obviously, it's not safe to. And we made a huge amount of garbage. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing to keep in mind is people were just bringing stuff, right? Food, whatever, constant stuff in. My kids were little. Everybody was kind of keeping an eye on them. But Alex got into a box. He was the five-year-old. He got into a box of chocolate-covered donut holes. And I think he might have eaten the entire box. So this is Arizona in July. And if you've ever been in a monsoon, it's monsoon season down there in the summer. And you'll have these torrential rains, just like water pouring out of the sky. And then they stop really abruptly. So we've got all this garbage. Oh, and if you put garbage bags loose, like next to your garbage can, the garbage people wouldn't pick it up. So once your garbage can was full, that was it. So we had all this extra garbage, but all the neighbors had their garbage cans out, and I knew theirs weren't full. So I just put my garbage into their cans, but it started one of these huge monsoon rains. So I'm running up and down the street in the rain, putting garbage in my neighbor's garbage cans. There's this torrential rain coming down, and I walk back into my house, and Alex runs out of the kitchen and almost projectile vomits chocolate-covered donut holes all over the wall. And my sister and I just looked at each other, and neither of us could stop laughing. We sat down right on the floor because it was just like, really? What? It's just like, there's thunder, there's lightning, there's pouring rain. I'm running up and down the street with extra medical garbage, and my child has just painted the wall with chocolate vomit.
Well, for some people, that would be the last straw that would put them over the edge. And it sounds like for you, you just found the humor in the moment and just couldn't do anything but laugh.
It was too absurd. It was just too absurd. And there was one point actually early in my writing career that my agent said something to me about that I had a keen eye for the absurd. And all I could think was like, come live my life. It's nothing but a parade of that.
Don't you think everybody's is if they're tuned in? It seems to me like everybody's life is a little ridiculous.
It is, because, you know, none of us are normal. I mean, there is no normal. We all have our little buttons and things that happen. And, you know, I think that's part of why those books spoke to people, is because they could see those situations and they could see themselves right in it, because it's something that would have happened to them.
Well, who hasn't gotten the giggles at an inappropriate time, at a funeral or something like that? Who hasn't had that happen? But it sounds like for you, that not only was just an expression of who you are and how you're, it sounds like your family is a funny family, but it also sounds like that's how you restore yourself too.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it that way. I've always thought about it as sort of a coping mechanism. But I do think it is restorative that, because it's very rare that you're laughing alone. It's a shared experience with someone, and it's a connection. I think humor is like a great way to connect with other people. It's part of why I like writing funny books. I think, you know, if you think something's funny and I think something's funny, we're connected. We have a similar worldview.
Mm. Well, I learned a while back that I love movies and I go to lots and lots of them, more than I ought probably. But I don't mind going to the movies alone at all. In fact, I almost prefer it when it's a drama or a documentary, but I don't like to go to a comedy by myself. It feels too lonesome to laugh alone at something and not to turn to somebody and say, wasn't that hilarious? And not to have walking out of the theater saying, oh my gosh, that cracked me up.
Yeah.
It seems like there's something, like you said, there's connective tissue there in our humor, in our shared humor.
And it makes it more special. But I hadn't thought about it as a restorative thing. But I think that there's, in that connection, it's something that the energy flows back in to you from it somehow.
So it sounds like not only humor, but lots of support was around you. You count yourself fortunate, I know, for having friends and family and neighbors and who will let you put medical garbage in their trash can. But I wonder what in your private moments were the inspirations or support or ideas that you had or decisions that you made about how you were going to go forward after such a huge loss.
Not too long after Fred died, I started looking for support groups. We'd been on hospice, and hospice is always so wonderful. And they were like, these are really helpful to people. You should think about it. And I went to a few, and I would be almost always the only person under 60 there. And people were saying things like, I don't know why I get out of bed in the morning. I don't know why I keep putting one foot in front of the other. And it didn't resonate with me because I knew why I got out of bed in the morning. I got out of bed because I was the only one who could reach the toaster and put the frozen waffles in. The kids couldn't do that themselves. They needed me and I needed to keep going. I needed to move. So I kept looking and I finally stumbled on a support group that was started by a woman who had lost her husband fairly young. And I think it originally was called Widows with Children. And then they were changing the name so that because men lose spouses too. And I found so much support there and ways to continue to honor Fred's memory without letting it mire me down. Because I was there with a bunch of other parents who were doing the same things I was doing. And it was incredibly helpful.
Do you think that's what gave you permission to welcome new love in your life? Without feeling so guilty and awful about it?
One of the funny things, maybe not so funny, I could not believe the number of people who were just waiting to fix me up with somebody. It's like they were just, once they realized that Fred was not going to make it, they were like, well, let's get her back into something. So that helped a lot. That seemed like people were like, yes, go.
So nobody was judging you or saying, oh, it's too soon, not yet. Nobody was saying that to you.
But in my head, sometimes I was. And we joke about it now, but my boyfriend was a little maybe commitment phobic. And I did not want to move quickly with anything. And in fact, when we first started seeing each other, we did not even live in the same state. And my need to go slow and his commitment phobia really made it easier to take things just little step by little step.
And he is your partner today, I believe, correct?
Yes, he is. Yes.
That would be a dangerous question to ask if I didn't think I knew the answer. Does that seem like forever ago or yesterday?
It seems like yesterday, but it also seems a bit like a dream. Like I'm watching it from outside. I think in some ways I still can't go all the way deep into how that felt at the time because it was insanity. My oldest sister came one time. I'm trying to remember exactly the sequence of events, but she called me to see how things were going. And I said, not good. Can you get on a plane today? And she was there that evening, but so then she took over the kids for a day so I could go be with Fred while he had surgery and ended up with a migraine so bad she had to go to bed with an ice pack on her head for a day. It's just like, it just didn't feel doable sometimes.
No. Well, I imagine it was stressful for everybody, to try to rally the troops and figure out where to put your grief energy and where to put your helper energy And then where do you put your how do I take care of me moment?
Yeah. And funny things happened. There was one, I think it might have even been that same trip, because my sister was there. And my kids were going to a birthday party in the afternoon, which was great because that meant they were taken care of for the afternoon. But I needed to go buy a gift. So there was a Target really close to my parents' apartment. And I walked in and there was a rack of clearance dresses that were $6. And they were super cute. And I called my sister and I said, you have to come to Target right now. Our mom can watch the kids as long as they're like absorbed in a TV show. So put on a movie, get over here. And we probably bought four dresses apiece. And it was just like, and we were like whispering to each other. It's like, hurry, hurry, get it. No, the other size. No, that one. And then, cause like we knew it was like this stolen moment of we get to buy clothes. For us.
A stolen moment that was for you and not about dying and not about healthcare and not about any of those things, but just, so it sounds like one of the things that you did organically was to find those little escape valves here and there that would let the steam out of what you were kind of going through.
I think writing provided some of that. Mm-hmm. I used to draw a lot. That provided some of it. There were all these little places where I could find a place where I didn't feel like I was whirling in circles all the time, where a moment of stillness that I felt that I really needed. Hmm. If that makes any sense.
Oh, it absolutely makes sense to me. It's what John Bradshaw years ago said, the difference between being a human doing versus a human being, that now and then you just have to be, and you have to stop all the do that distracts us from who we are and from what we're going through and from the genuine emotions that we're dealing with. So, Eileen, I have one last question or two, and that is, I'm curious about the choice of fictionalizing your story. And I know that there are some things in this book that are just imagined, of course, but I'm curious about why you chose to do this as a book of fiction and not as a memoir.
I think doing it as a fictional story, well, A, it gives you license to make it work out any way you want, but which is always nice. But I think it provided that little bit of distance for me. Just that little piece that I can, you know, that protected me so I could still process it and feel it without going completely down into that old pit.
It sounds like the book was your therapist.
I really felt like it was. I really did. You know, even at the time I knew that I was processing a lot of stuff. In fact, I don't think I totally knew what the book was about till I got near the end of it. And I was, you know, mapping out these journeys for the three sisters. And, you know, this sister was going to learn this and that sister was going to learn this. But the character who was based on me, what did she learn? And at first I was just, she's putting her life back together. What else does she have to learn? She's learning to live without her husband. And then I realized that a lot of it had to do with finding love again and the complicated feelings that brought up. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure that I'm totally done dealing with those. We watched a TV show the other night called The Unicorn. And it's about a man whose wife dies and he has kids and his friends want him to start dating again. And it's a sitcom. It's, you know, kind of cute and goofy and funny with, you know, a few moments of poignancy. And we watched the pilot and I thought, oh, I'm going to really like this. And I got to the end of it and I'm like, I can't do this. I can't watch this show. It feels too on the nose for me. And I can't handle it.
Wow. So perhaps because it was a sitcom, which it sounds like your family is a bit of a sitcom, right?
No.
So it was just a little too close to home.
Yeah, a little too close to home. Absolutely. And there's, I can't watch. I am terrible about any book or movie or TV show with a brain tumor in it, because either it completely mirrors my experience and I am undone, or it's not my experience and I'm irritated that they've gotten it all wrong. So it's just like, oh, it's a brain tumor book. I can't read it.
Well, but that's also is a bit of self-care too, of saying, you know what? I don't have to watch movies that have brain tumor stories in them. I don't have to suffer this. It sounds like you've dealt with lots and lots of this, but you don't have to pick the scabs off of it every single day by watching the things that are painful and awful all the time.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it felt like to watch that sitcom. I mean, it was, I don't know. I thought it was pretty well done. And I just like, no, it feels like you're just picking a scab off. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, now one last thing. And that is that I know that you're prolific and you've crossed genres into more murderous kinds of things. So I also want to say too, I've used the word chick lit when I described Do Me, Do My Roots, and that's sort of how these books were described at one time. But I have to say that yours stands out because it's written in that kind of fluffy rom-com kind of style, but it's written also with substance and poignancy, and it's really beautifully written too. So it's slighted by the title of the genre. So my apologies for that. It's really just a book that is accessible and commercial fiction, but that is well written and talks about grief as well, which is a rare thing in that genre. And I want to congratulate you for that.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. So you've turned to more murderous kinds of stories now. Can you say a little bit about what you write now? And
sometimes I don't even know what to say. I have been writing cozy mysteries, which are super fun to write. And the tone is very similar to the chick. The term chick lit never really bothered me that much. I suppose it probably should. But the cozies have a similar tone and a similar feel. And I recently started working with a PR firm, and they were looking at all these books and saying, you know, you've got to find some kind of unifying message. There's got to be something here that brings the chick lit and the urban fantasy and the psychological suspense and that brings it all together. And after a while of brainstorming, we realized that all of my books are basically about a woman whose life has completely fallen apart and she is putting it back together. So that's a theme that I seem to just come back to over and over and over.
And without intention, you didn't intend that always. It just seems to always be what you write about.
Yeah. And I do wonder now that I'm a little more aware of it, it's like, oh, the next book proposal I do, is it going to be like that?
Have I burst the bubble now that I know what it is?
Now that I know.
And Eileen, you publish under Eileen Rendall, but what are your other nom de plumes?
So I have some romantic suspense under Eileen Carr.
K-A-R-R or C-A-R-R?
C-A-R-R. I have two cozy mystery series, one under Christy Abbott and the other under Lillian Bell.
Eileen, it's been a delight to talk with you, and thank you for sharing your personal story and your writing story. And I know that your books provide comfort and entertainment and distraction and even some insight into grief and loss. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for being part of the Morning Glory Project. You are certainly a bloom worth celebrating.
Oh, Betsy, thank you so much.
Eileen gave us lots to think about in our interview today. And the extra blooms that I have on my mind are how humor was both a benefit and a curse to her in her own recovery from grief process, that at first it protected her, but then it actually kept her from grieving, and how family, loved ones, and joy came back into her life as she was able to get through those details. I'm so pleased to have talked to Eileen and inspired by her story. You can find out more about Eileen and a bunch of the other Morning Glory people at themorninggloryproject.com. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode of The Morning Glory Project, do us a favor, subscribe to the others. I know that you'll find the other stories equally as inspiring. And if you're so inclined, go on to the places where you subscribe to podcasts and give us a like or a positive review. It sure helps us get heard. Thanks for listening. Bye.